Greetings. Welcome to the ONTIC Protective Intelligence Podcast. I'm Chuck Randolph, ONTIC's Chief Security Officer. From 30 years as a military officer and over 25 transforming corporate security teams to function beyond their traditional roles, protection, risk management, and threat mitigation have been front and center throughout my career. This podcast series will explore the turbulent world of risk, security, and protective strategies through conversations with leaders and innovators in the field. Now, on to the discussion. Lou Silvestri currently leads the Risk Intelligence and Investigations team in the Protective Services Division at American Family Insurance. His team is responsible for proactively identifying, assessing, and mitigating real and potential global risks and threats to its company's people, assets, and events. They support strategic decision-making with meaningfully accurate and timely analysis of potential risks to the company, along with leading mitigation risk associated with potential workplace violence. Prior to AmFam, Lou previously worked for several multinational consulting companies. He began his career in the CIA as an analyst covering weapons development and proliferation, transitioning to counter-narcotics operations and then counter-terrorism operations. He served on several task forces related with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies for over 10 years, and in his final assignment, Lou was the Chief Intelligence Officer at Homeland Security Investigations, the Newark, New Jersey office. There, he implemented a new agency-wide intelligence program for managing groups of analysts and investigators. Lou earned an MA in International Relations from Rutgers University and a BA in Political Science from Seton Hall University. Lou, welcome to the ONTIC Protective Intelligence Podcast, my friend.
Thanks, Chuck. Glad to be here. Glad to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's exciting to when I'm able to get someone like you behind the mic, because I think you have so much to share. This could almost, I think, be a 2 or 3 part podcast. I know you just went, wait, what? Nobody told me that.
No, definitely willing to do something like that. Very interested.
You have such a background. I mean, and you have a myriad of work experience, I think, that all draws to where you are today. So tell us, you know, you started in the intelligence field. So what drew you to intelligence work? And, you know, ultimately, how did that help your career and your journey to end up where you are today at American Family Insurance?
Sure. You'll see as I go through this that definitely not a straight path. Don't know if it was really planned out, and still very much, you know, in the process of learning, I think, what I want to do and in my career. But I was, you know, out of high school, went into college without really knowing what I wanted to do. I'd always been interested in law enforcement and, you know, those types of things growing up. That's just kind of what I was interested in. And in college, it was, you know, I had been put into the business administration program, and I looked at all of the math courses that were involved, and I said, there's no way, absolutely no way. You know, it was like four classes in trigonometry, and I just, no, I could not do that. So switched to political science, which was probably the opposite end of the spectrum. I went to Seton Hall University, good education, I think. But I'm still in the middle of that, really not knowing what I wanted to do. And then, I had always been interested in, I think, CIA, just because of the mystique of it. This is going back quite a few years. So it wasn't a lot of the information, that's available now wasn't. So anyway, I fast forward, there was an internship program that was available to do between your junior and senior year. I applied for it, got through that, and then there was a hiring freeze. So then it was like, wound up then applying again, got into it, and was, you know, started actually in the science and technology area, but had no background in that. It was one of those things where it was, hey, this is where we're hiring this year. Are you interested? So I said, sure, you know, and it was a great experience because I kind of started off doing weapons proliferation work, and there was a lot of training involved in that. So for me, it was great. I loved it that, you know, I'm getting all this training and I'm like, you're actually paying me to do this? You know, one of those things. You know, after a couple of years, it was, I knew I wanted more than that, which, and that was an analytical job. So I knew I wanted something more kind of in the field and something faster paced. Again, I'm doing this like straight out of college, you know, 24 years old. So I switched over to counter narcotics. Love that. It was much more, it was quicker paced. It was, I mean, some of the stuff we did was really, you know, cool stuff. From that, you know, after 9/11 happened, I went over to counterterrorism. And that's what I really, really enjoyed working, and spent pretty much the most of my career, rest of my career doing that. Last couple of years, I actually had the chance to be detailed over to Homeland Security investigations worked on setting up their intelligence program. So at the end of that, it was a question of then going back to Washington, D.C., which I knew I didn't want to just for personal reasons, or leaving the agency. So
the beltway, why you don't want to go have that, you don't want to have that commute every day?
No, I had done it for 5 years when I started. And I knew what it was, and I knew it wasn't for me. There's, you know, as you probably very well aware, people in the government, I think not just in the agency, but across the government, you get the people that are really there for the mission first. And then you get the people that, and this isn't making a judgment one way or another. There's people there that know they want this to be their career, and they're going to be a lifelong bureaucrat. Nothing, it's just, you know, two different types.
It takes both to run an agency. I mean, that's the honest to goodness truth is there's folks that are there for the mission, the folks in the field, but it does take administrators to administrate, or it doesn't 100%.
Happen. Yeah, 100%. And especially, I think, because I had gone in so early and I enjoyed what I was doing in terms of the work, I always enjoyed the more tactical level work, and that's what I was there for. So it was kind of I don't want to say an easy decision, but it was one of those things where I had kind of prepared myself that when the call came, and I knew it was going to come eventually to come back, it just wasn't for me. So I was lucky enough to then start working, got a job offer at a financial tech company very quickly after I left. And that was because of the connections that I had with former agency people as well. Was a huge help. And I kind of fell into that role quickly. It was my first experience really in the corporate sector. I had never had, you know, quote unquote, a real job up until that point. And it was a good learning experience. I got to help set up the operations center, professionalize that, then kind of moved over into the geopolitical risk area and travel security. Mm-hmm. All of those things were, I would say, a natural fit with my agency experience. And a lot of that, you know, when I get asked about what I did in the agency and how that kind of prepares you, a lot of it is, I would say, less on the operational side, but just more on the things that you soak up being there. So whether that's, you know, critical thinking, writing, foreign travel, you're just, you know, you're exposed to a lot of that stuff. And you just, if you're a sponge, like I am, you just try to soak up everything. And transitioning into the corporate world, my big realization was, you know, a lot of the things that you work with in the government, with people in the government, they all kind of have that shared experience where there's that baseline level of knowledge that a lot of corporate sector people just don't have. And, you know, probably the best example of that is foreign travel. Just laying out, hey, here's some basic things to keep you safe, and that never would have occurred.
Just people. Travel alone. I mean, think about it from an analyst's point of view, or even a leader's point of view. We talk about a foreign place, like, you know, you're in a multinational. We might have an office in Nigeria, but if you've never really traveled, then it becomes an idea as opposed to something, you know, that you might have experienced, and now you can conceive like the difference in culture, the nuance of culture. I think there's something to that that's very important, especially if you're working in a multinational that, you know, we can easily forget because we get locked into our own, you know, cognitive bias or, you know, cultural bias of our team, if you will.
What I found interesting in that job, at least, was we had a very large footprint in India, and we had a lot of Indian born employees in the US that would travel to India. And you kind of have to take a step back and say, like, you know, yes, I'm going to provide you the security stuff, but you're also from that country. And there's a lot of stuff that I'm not going to try to explain to you because it's going to come off probably kind of condescending. And so that was another like big difference, I think, between the corporate sector and government.
Well, let me ask you a couple follow-ups on that. One, like at 9/11, I mean, that was such a travesty for many people around the world, especially, you know, U.S. citizens, New Yorkers. What was 9/11 like for you where you were in the agency? I mean, can you, like, I'm sure you can remember what that was, hearing that news, and then how did that, like, how did that change your perception of the mission, if you will, and how has that carried forward with you?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was, I would say, a huge impact on my life in retrospect, just because I had been with the agency at that point for 4 years, I think, little more. Mm-hmm. And I had been working counter-narcotics, which, as I said, I loved, but I was also reaching the point quickly of realizing that it was a never-ending mission, and kind of questioning, you know, I mean, I was fortunate enough to, because so much of this stuff is timing and whether it's luck or just circumstances, huge successes in that counter-narcotics position, but then also saw that 2 weeks later, a new cartel had moved in and everything was back to normal. So, you know, and there's a couple movies that really show that. But anyway, I was at a point where I was kind of really questioning, am I going to stay with the agency? Not that I had been in that long, but I'm like, what's next for me? And I had always had an interest in counterterrorism, but 9/11 happens, and it was, probably one of the worst things that happened to the country. But overnight, you saw the agency change at every level, where everybody had this, you know, we want to get this done. We want, you know, the mission is kind of renewed. The gloves are off, and I was at the headquarters building in McLean, and we heard that there had been a crash of the first plane, and then put the TVs on. We saw this, you know, the second one go in, and everybody was like, okay, this isn't an accident. This is an attack. And then there was throughout that day, it was kind of, okay, where are these other planes heading? And then we were getting reports that the CIA headquarters building was going to be targeted. So everybody was evacuated, which was absolutely surreal. And I still remember to this day standing, you're trying to get all of these people out of this big building. No plans had really been made for that. And people were just standing on the lawn in the grass talking to each other. And we're like, you know, because you didn't want to try to like get into that traffic snafu. And it was just a very surreal moment. But I kind of decided, you know, next day I'm like, I want to work counterterrorism. And as you know, I think probably 75% of the agency probably had that same desire. But I made it kind of my mission. I wanted to work, you know, something very directly related to New York, especially having grown up there. And so I was fortunate enough to have it done. Probably, you know, some of the best experiences that I've ever had on terrorism task forces.
We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment, but first, I wanted to tell you about the ONTX Center for Connected Intelligence. In the world of safety, security, and protection, we know that gathering and sharing information is crucial. That is why we created the ONTX Center for Connected Intelligence. The center is a hub for the ongoing exchange of security strategies and best practices, insights on current and past trends, and sharing valuable learnings through expert discussion and analysis. It's made up of seasoned experts with decades of experience across a wide range of disciplines. To find blogs, podcasts, webinars, white papers, and more, check out the center by visiting ontic.co/center. That's ontic.co/center. So then with all that focus that you know continues forward from 9/11. I mean, you've been working counterterror at the agency, and now you step over into Homeland Security to say, look, I need to now take that focus, that mission drive, and start something new. What's that like?
So after having worked counterterrorism for probably close to about 10 years, I was looking for a change, and a lot of that had to do, I think, with not only me working that issue for so long, which I really enjoyed, but the mission was changing. You know, when I was working counterterrorism, I'd say, you know, it was the years right after 9/11 where it was the major terrorist groups with big plots against America. And over time, that kind of, I'd say, died down a bit, mostly because of our success against them. But then you had the new breed of terrorists cropping up where it was more, you know, homegrown or foreign fighter, self-radicalized, which mm-hmm. was still very interesting. But there was, at least from the operations that I was involved in, less of a role for the agency as opposed to more of a role mm-hmm. for FBI, Homeland Security. And so I got the opportunity to work very closely with Homeland Security investigations, and an opportunity came up to do a detail assignment to help them set up their intelligence program. Right. And the one that I was working on was specifically in Newark. And it was very frustrating, but it was a great experience, great learning experience. I managed, I think it was 14 people, which was new for me. It really had a lot of potential, but I think there wasn't enough push from the headquarters level. And then also in the field, there was a lot of resistance, I would say, to that. And it was just because of the kind of the ingrained culture that was there. I think it was kind of a missed opportunity, but hopefully, you know.
A missed opportunity for culture change, a missed opportunity by Homeland Security or by the greater intelligence community?
I think all three. You know, there's, mm-hmm. if you look closely at the authorities that Homeland Security Investigations has, there's great potential there for doing more. Not to say they don't do a lot. They do a great job on the law enforcement side, but there's, I would say, an equal opportunity for them to have a more expanded intelligence role that I just don't think has been capitalized on, and not for lack of some key players trying to push that. It's, you know, you probably know this. It's like trying to turn an aircraft carrier. There's a lot of, and again, going further away from 9/11, the impetus for that, I think, declines, unfortunately.
Well, the focus becomes diminished. Right. I feel bad saying that, but I think it's realities of bureaucracy. At some point, The focus becomes diminished and it slowly goes back to whatever the air quotes new norm becomes. And then we go back to administration, we go back to operations, we go back to, and I think you're right, there was a bunch of agencies that were, hey, we're all intelligence agencies now.
Right.
But what were they? Are they? And I can see where that would be frustrating to come in and say, okay, we have the ability to do some really great things and go.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, from there I had gone over to or left the government. I was over at the financial tech company, and then I kind of knew it was time to leave there, and mm-hmm. was looking for my next, where I was going to go next. And mm-hmm. Combination of factors, I left late 2019 thinking that, I'll get a job in a couple months. Then the pandemic happens. Basically sat at home for close to a year, which was its own, it's at the time not fun, but it offered some chance to kind of decide, like, what do I really want to do?
And forced navel gazing, my friend, whether we liked it or not, everybody in the world had to do it. And those who say, I don't do it, I say, you did. You just don't want to admit it.
Yes. So long story short with that, I kind of stumbled into an opportunity to talk to the head of protective services at American mm-hmm. Family. And American Family happened to be, again, everybody's going through this new thing, the pandemic, and they're mm-hmm. all work from home. And what it gave protective services and a lot of other things in other offices in American Family was the opportunity to recruit beyond where they had normally looked at, which was the Midwest. And I got hired into a remote position, never having worked remote, but now having done that, I would never want to go back if I can avoid it.
What is it about that you find that is maybe more conducive for you personally?
For me, so a number of things. And I think part of it is the job I was hired into, intelligence and investigations. It's, I don't want to say it's 24/7, but you always have to be able to respond. You don't work normal hours. I mean, you work your 9 to 5, but you can't control when an incident comes in. So you can work 9-10 hour day, and then at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, you get something and it has to be looked at right away. So just the ability to do that from home is great. And then,
well, you said earlier, like, look, a lot of this job, whether you're in the public side or the private side, especially from your precipice, it involves critical thinking, deep thinking. Not everything can be summed up into 180 characters. And then, like, I had an old boss that used to say, be bright, be brief, be gone. But I think that's kind of BS if you'll allow that joke, because especially from an insurance company point of view, that risk is their business. So I can only imagine that having the ability to say, okay, I'm going to need 25 minutes of quiet time to examine what is happening, what's our courses of action, and what's our response.
Yeah. And I mean, that's perfectly said. And, the contrast to that would be, in the government, and especially in my previous corporate sector job, you had to be there. And in the corporate sector, especially writing geopolitical risk pieces in an office is...
Especially if you're in an open concept environment. Sorry, people, I just said it. It's terrible. No,
100%. And that's my, I would say, big frustration with corporate America. And it's not, obviously not I'm making a generalization here, but
yeah, of course,
it's not, especially security. There's just a lot of jobs that don't fit into the cookie cutter mold. And to try to,
we try to make them fit in though. We try our best to just hammer the oblong into the square, if you will. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
But yeah, to be able to sit at home, give me 30 minutes and I can bang something out no distractions.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, and then, after you've done that, okay, I focused, I've got this done. Now let's get ready for the deluge of what ifs. Let's do this. Coordination, as I think about your career and what we've just been talking about, something I'm sure that you draw through all of your public, now private side, is look, the ability to coordinate efforts, which I think is an unsung superpower of many people in security, because at the end of the day, we're all purple. It's all joint. We're just trying to get everyone to the table. Let's all talk about the same thing in the same way so we can enable the bosses to make decisions.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think especially on the task forces that I worked for, that was key. Yeah. I mean, in New York, I think at its height, there were something like 37, 38 different agencies. And it was a monster. I mean, there were, I can't even remember how many people.
How does anything get done with that? I mean, I remember in information operations having to sit with host country. And then you have all the various agencies from the U.S. You might end up having 10 or 12. And that was almost insurmountable. I can't even imagine 30.
Yeah. And it was, and obviously not everyone is involved in every case,
sure.
But when you
they
get
wanna
something,
be.
No, exactly. There's that end that for sure. But what I've always found is, with few exceptions, that at the working level, it's always easier. It's where it gets up to.
Yeah, you're right.
The heads of the agencies and I get it. I mean, it's like at that, when you're in those positions, you're protecting your agency's equity or offices, whatever the case may be, all of those equities. But even in the private sector, I've always found at the working level, much easier to coordinate. And I think part of that too is you're dealing with other experts and everybody kind of knows what they're good in, and you hope that people just don't get involved for the sake of being involved. You always get some of that, but luckily, you can kind of, I think if you know what you're doing and you're confident, you can steer those coordination meetings to the way that they need to go. And then you just really hope that your leadership is supportive enough of you to kind of trust what you're doing, and not get involved where they don't need to be.
Yeah. And I think that's a sign of a good boss too. And I'm sure you've carried that forward. Like, look,
yeah,
I need to know, a leader needs to be where he or she can best control the operation. Sometimes that's in the back with a cup of be quiet. And sometimes that's in the front helping manage, and manage, priorities and requirements. But I think there's a bit of a nuanced element to leadership.
Yes.
That kind of helps you understand, like, where do I need to be best now to, to create energy, create some direction and drive for results.
No, completely agree. And that's one of the things, I would say I've had enough first line managers that were in the weeds too much to take that experience and say, that's definitely not going to be me. Like I try to let people do their thing because they're the experts, and then try to give them the cover that they need, when they need it. And, and then just be frank with them, telling them like, hey, this has the attention of the CEO. Like,
yes,
people are going to be involved that don't need to be, but just understand that's the reality.
Make sure you've read this to yourself out loud and it makes sense. But I want to ask you a question. I am not a fan of the what keeps you up at night question. I want to preface that. However, with someone that has your myriad background from public investigations, intelligence to tech, geopolitical risk, and now, you know, senior manager. You know, what are the biggest concerns that you think we're facing today? What are, you know, not necessarily, you know, this isn't, what does AmFam think, but what do you think from where you are? Like, what's concerning it and of interest to you?
Sure. And I'll say, I'll split that into two parts. The first, I'd say on the in my job and the tactical level is the possibility of a workplace violence incident.
Absolutely.
Now, when you look at that, you know, when you look at the stats, it's still very unlikely. But it's the fact that you don't know and have somewhat limited control over that. And from specifically in, with AmFam, my real concern is more on the customer or random person that has the mental health or perceived grievance, you know, kind of going back to that. And I think AmFam did a really great job putting this report together a couple of years ago about permacrisis and the risk landscape. That document was so helpful to us, kind of laying out the what's going on in the world and how then we're seeing that affect us. And specifically, you know, all of those stressors, from whether it's financial or, you know, fallout from lockdowns, COVID, all of that stuff, for lack of a better term, that's I think it's really done something to a large portion of our population, especially in the U.S., where there's a serious mental health crisis going on and a lot of people not getting help. And whether those, you know, a customer or a random person is serious about that threat, you always have to investigate it.
And 100%.
That's, you know, and those are the ones that I would say we know about. What keeps me up at night going a little further about that is the ones where it is, and this is nothing specific to AmFam,
right,
but where somebody really is serious about it and they're good enough or smart enough to keep it quiet.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because let's be honest, like somewhere right now, as people are listening to this, there's someone who's thinking about doing something very, very bad, evil, if you will. And there's not just one person, there's many and many and many. And I think you're absolutely right. It's the ones that, you know, oh, we missed that, or we could have tracked that, or the one that just completely is like off the grid, you know, slowly and quietly considering or percolating, if you will.
Yeah. And in the, you know, in the government on the terrorism side, it was always, or counterterrorism, it was, we've got to be perfect or right or lucky all the time. And they just have to get lucky once and it's going to, you know, be a major incident. And, you know, I think the same thing applies with workplace violence or mass shooting incidents, things like that. Yeah. You can't be everywhere all the time. So I think that's, you know, on a granular or tactical level, that's what keeps me up at night. And then in the bigger picture of things, I think it's similar, with all of those other factors going on with the mental health issues and inflation, all that. But then, what we're also seeing, you know, in the United States and then also in the world, there's a lot of just, I don't want to, for lack of a better term, weird stuff going on.
No, that's a technical term.
You know, it's, you know, I can try to go through all these explanations, but I feel more uneasy now than it after 9/11. And 9/11, you know, after 9/11, it was, especially in those couple of years right after it, it was always, you know, the follow-on attack. They were planning something. Mm-hmm. We know that, and we prevented a bunch of them. But at least you kind of, I think, knew where the threat was coming from. And right. just look at, I mean, the past couple of years, especially what's been going on. And, you know, not going to get into the conspiracy theory world, but there's a lot of things that I see happening in the United States that if I was looking at that happening in another country, or historically things, similar things that have happened, it's kind of hard not to think that some of these things, while they may not be specifically connected, that there's more behind them than just what ran like random occurrences. That worries me. You know, I mean, you look at how many food production facilities have had accidents or railway accidents. I mean, the power grid, I don't even want to get into that. You know, so
critical infrastructure will be another podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So that's strategically, I think, the big thing that worries me.
I think there's a certain amount of information operations that goes to all that too. Like, look, we're at a place now where we're the ability to see information is greater than it's ever been. You know, I don't necessarily say there's more information, but the greater to see all that information is greater than it's ever been. So now we can see all these various risk touch points, which makes me think, like, for you in your position, like thinking about like modernization technology, how does technology play into that for you? I mean, because at the end of the day, we all have limited resources, especially on the private side. But the expectation, the mission, and the function remains, you know, to protect the greater organization that you belong to. I mean, how do you view modernization or technology to support you in that?
Yeah, and that's a great transition. You know, I would say going back 2 years now, I started at AmFam in the position that was, I think, January of 2021. So mm-hmm. been here about 3 years now. And the efforts to modernize and expand the security program as a whole was underway already. And part of the reason I was brought in was to kind of do that specifically with the intelligence mm-hmm. and investigations program. And we had a pretty strong program to begin with. But there were definitely, you know, again, you're looking at the time frame, everybody's working from home. What does that mean for security? And now mm-hmm. instead of 90% of your workforce working in locations that you know, you probably got 90% that are work from home. And what does that mean to duty of care, you know, responding to people, taking care of them, investigating? It makes the job that much more difficult, I would say. And in terms of, like you were saying, much more information that you have to keep track of. So we knew that we needed to modernize with our technology to help out with that, because you're never going to hire enough bodies. And I mean, maybe you could if you actually got the funding, but I think everybody knows that's not going to happen. And my team is small. We've got two investigators and two analysts. And they cross over in some of their roles. But, you know, for me, the first thing is when I heard about, I had gotten a briefing about ONTIC, and I said, wow, you can combine intel and investigations into one platform. And the ability to not only combine that into one platform, but to have it go out and monitor things automatically for you. I mean, that's like a game changer. I can't stress how big of a leap that is in abilities. You know, and I'll give one example. We have, you know, we say you have a case, an investigation, and it's somebody that potentially wants to do something against the company, has shown up at the company's location, a former employee, say, mm-hmm. Okay, we mitigate the threat, they're arrested, they get released, you know, soon thereafter, that grievance doesn't go away. And now what do you do? How much resources can you put out of a two-person intel team to monitor by hand every day social media, and the investigators check to see if there's any updates, if they're arrested, released, yeah, things like that? It's just, you know, okay, you can do that, but then what drops off? And if you get two or three of those at the same time, you're tapped out completely. And I, like, you know, the example I use over and over again is MI5 back in, yep, in the day. I won't give out the specific number, but you know, they had told us a specific number of cases that they were able to handle. And it got to the point where, okay, you know, we've got X number of cases on our docket, and we've got to prioritize now. So then you have to take an action to disrupt it or somehow close it. With corporate investigations, you really don't have that choice.
Yeah, that's a really good point between, say, like a .gov or a .le and a .com. I mean, I remember, exactly, a time in my life where I had thousands of persons of interest or groups, mm-hmm, of interest that we were monitoring. And, you know, you couldn't just say, well, this one hasn't done anything in about 2 months, we'll just let that go. I mean, there was always some level of monitoring.
Yeah. And so, I mean, all of that to say, for the investigations and intelligence side, ONTIC was a game changer, because a lot of those capabilities, you set them up, it runs in the background, and then, you know, 6 months after you're looking at somebody, you get an alert that they were just arrested and released for whatever the charge may be. Now you know, hey, I've got to keep a closer eye on this person. Are they going to show up again? And then that allows you to coordinate the mitigation efforts on the physical security side if there's a potential for them coming to their building.
Well, and I appreciate the comment on ONTIC, not required, but I do appreciate that. But, you know, the understanding of, like, look, I need technology to augment the human, because at the end of the day, what are we doing on the intelligence and the investigative side? We're enabling action at some point. Information becomes intelligence when you put action on it. And then, you know, investigation becomes another arm, especially when you think about protective intelligence. And it is a call for action, even if the action is continued monitoring or something. So I appreciate your thoughts on that. Let me ask you a question. I'm sure people are thinking right now, hey, look, I'm in an organization. You know, we've talked about bureaucracy. We've talked about, you know, focus. We've talked about tech. I want to start making some changes. I'm looking to modernize. I'm looking to culturally change, or just change the organization I'm in, or I've been tasked to do that. I mean, you've done that multiple times, my friend. What, you know, off the top of your head, what would be your advice to those folks? Like, start here. You know, most things, like, start small, but I mean, how do you even start?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't think there's any right answer to that. What I've found, though, is you really need to get as good of an understanding of whether it's a company or an organization that you're working at. Get as good of an understanding as possible. And that includes, what are the main, say it's security, what are, mm-hmm, the main security issues? What are the main risks? How are those security issues and risks viewed by the leadership? Because, mm-hmm, what I found is, you know, as security professionals, we look at something and we're like, hey, there's a risk there. You need to address that. Corporate leadership may view it as, yeah, as a risk, but we're willing to tolerate it, or, right, we're willing to accept it. So that, I think, is key to before you start out on this. And then once you do start out, you've got to do the groundwork of the policies, the procedures, what metrics you're going to collect. And that's, you know, it may sound like fairly straightforward, but especially on the metric side,
that's what are we measuring?
Yeah. And so that's going to help you, one, justify whatever you're proposing, but then also show whatever progress or changes
right.
that you're doing. And, you know, for my team, we've seen over the last 3 or so years, we've seen a large increase in the number of reported workplace violence incidents. First reaction is, oh, what's going on here? But then you have to look at it in the context of, you know, one, we haven't, knock on wood, haven't had an actual incident. These are reports of concerns that we're investigating. And so really you can turn that around and say, hey, we've had this huge increase, but we continue to mitigate these. So it's working. And then you always have to look at it in terms of you're trying to get your name out there for your program. So are these increased reports a function of that as well? Mm-hmm. More people know what to report, which is good because, you know, workplace violence, that's probably one of the major concerns in any program is the, you know, vast underreporting of incidents. So I think all of those are key. And then probably the biggest thing is to be flexible. If you don't already realize it, you're in corporate America, you're part of the company and the company's goals, they're changing focuses. All of that is going to affect you. Now, sometimes, and we were lucky to do this when we onboarded Ontic, there was a drive in the company for digital transformation. Ontic fit in perfectly for that. And I don't know if we would have been able to actually get it on board without tying it to that. So it was you get those too, where it's like, hey, this fits in perfectly with what we want to do. But then you're going to get the opposite. Part of the reason that I was looking or what was appealing to me about the insurance industry at the time was insurance industries were always kind of considered much more stable than, say, the finance industry. Well, I mean, geez, that's changed a lot in the last couple of years, whether it's inflation or all of these major storms. So, you know, right now we're kind of, you know, the insurance industry as a whole is looking to cut costs and kind of recoup that. So to push your program forward in that is very difficult. And it's just something that you kind of have to deal with, I think.
Yeah, I love it. Lou, how do people, if they want to maybe take this conversation offline with you directly or ask you some questions, I mean, what's the best place for people to get in touch with you?
Probably LinkedIn. I would say that's the easiest place on LinkedIn. Happy to connect with anybody that's interested in finding out more about this or, you know, any advice I could share. Definitely.
Well, and I highly recommend people get a hold of that AmFam Permacrisis report you talked about earlier. That was a good read. And I think it just has some good bits in it. I also love what you say about, look, get involved in your company and understand it before you make assumptions from where you came. Understand the place that you are, from the 10K all the way down to what they're reporting about before you, you know, basically look and think before you leap. Yeah. I love that. Clearly we'll have to do this again, my friend, because I've probably got 7 more questions that I want to ask you, but I want to be cognizant of time. So Lou, thank you so much for joining the Ontic Protective Intelligence podcast, my friend.
Thanks, Chuck. Really appreciate the opportunity and happy to come back at any time.
This episode was brought to you by the Ontic Center for Connected Intelligence. Learn more at ontic.co/center. Again, that's ontic.co/center. It was produced by AJ McKeon. Our music is a track called Monteverde Ride, and it was written by Brian Bristow and performed by the Smokin' Novas. Check them out on Spotify. please remember to rate and review our podcast on iTunes and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have questions, we'd love to hear them. You can reach us at podcast@ontic.co or visit ontic.co/center for more information. Thanks for listening.